I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another edition of The American Idea. My name is John Moser. I'm chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Ashland University. And I'd like to welcome you. And today we're going to talk about a phenomenon that is about 100 years old this year. The Harlem Renaissance, a tremendous cultural, literary, musical, you name it, movement that developed among the African community, African American community in the 1920s, and has left us with a great corpus of works and lasting cultural as well as political significance. And joining us to discuss that topic is my good friend David Krugler. Professor Krugler is a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin at Platteville. He has a PhD and a master's in history, both from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He is author of numerous books, including This Is Only a Test, How Washington, D.C. Prepared for Nuclear War, 1919, The Year of Racial Violence, How African Americans Fought Back. He is editor of the Cold War Core Documents, and he is also a published novelist with two novels to his credit, The Dead Don't Bleed and Rip the Angels from Heaven, both of which I've read and which are excellent. David Krugler, thank you for being here with us.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to join you this morning to talk about the Harlem Renaissance.
Dave, one of the first questions that comes to my mind is, what's the significance of the historical time and the historical place? Why Harlem? Why the 1920s?
It's hard to understate the importance of time and place when we look at this multifaceted cultural, musical, artistic, literary, and even political movement. For one, African Americans were beginning to define themselves as urban. And Harlem had benefited from the Great Migration in many ways, with thousands of Black Southerners moving to New York, hundreds of thousands of African Americans moving from the South to other northern cities as well. New York was also an international city. 50% of the foreign-born people of African descent living in the United States as of 1920 were in Harlem. So we have this enriched international aspect to it as well. Then there's the time period, the 1920s. After World War I, the United States overall is more urban. And so that gives you an incubator for culture. There's also a determination to fulfill the new Negro identity on the part of lots of African Americans. And Harlem becomes the epicenter for that. At the same time, we should note that the Harlem Renaissance wasn't just local to New York. It was national, and there were other areas in the United States, other cities, where we see an artistic, cultural, literary, and musical blossoming as well among African Americans and their supporters. They had a lot of white allies in the movement, too.
A couple things you said that I think are worth going further on. But early on, you said this was, for the first time, African Americans identified as urban. It seems to me this is particularly significant for the 1920s because so much of the culture of the 1920s is sometimes summarized as the clash between the urban and the rural. The 1920 census shows for the first time that the United States is an urban nation, sort of. So being urban is more than simply living in a city, right? It represents a set of values. Could you say some more about that?
Sure. I mean, what a lot of people are doing is they're associating urban life with modernism. And Alain Locke, who's one of the founders of the Harlem Renaissance, he was a professor of philosophy, but so much more at Howard University and lived in New York at this time. In talking about the emergence of a new Negro identity, which is essential to the Harlem Renaissance, he said, migration is an essential part of this, but it's not just about, quote, deliberate flight from countryside to city, but from medieval America to modern, end quote. Right? So it's the cities where you have a core group of people who can mingle and share ideas and be creative and produce this. You know, and this reflects this larger divide, and we have many prominent, famous examples of urban modernity versus rural tradition, the Scopes trial, most famously. But for the leaders and participants in the Harlem Renaissance, urbanness is associated with modernity and change and excitement and creativity.
What would you say are the main themes that show up in Harlem Renaissance literature, painting, music, etc.?
First, that Americans of African descent have a distinctive, rich culture of their own, which draws upon primarily West African traditions and culture, but which blends with European American modes of culture and produces something very distinct. We need to remind ourselves that going into the 1920s, what most school children are taught in the United States, whatever their race, they're taught that people of African descent never had any culture. And what they have, they've obtained crudely from the dominant culture, from European American culture. This leads to some pretty damaging stereotypes about African Americans, that they're not able to produce a literature on their own, that they mimic the music of whites. This helps lead to minstrelsy in the 1830s, and it's very prominent in the United States still by the 1920s. So you've got this two-part mission to first show and demonstrate this culture, and then use it to break down racist stereotypes and ignorance about African Americans. I would say that's the key thing to know about the Harlem Renaissance. A second key factor is that this creates a challenge, even a dilemma, for the progenitors of the Harlem Renaissance. To what extent should they intentionally frame their art against racist stereotypes or this ignorance? And to what extent should they say, let's just set it aside and be artistic and produce our work as we want, as creative people, and just let the responses come as they will?
What kind of, I had heard more of the second response, that we're going to try to tune out in a sense white society and produce the sort of things we want to produce and produce it for our community. What are there examples you can give of the former, of trying to go head on against the stereotyping?
Yes. So you've got W.E.B. Du Bois, who in many writings puts forward the argument that what Black art and literature should do is break down these stereotypes. Langston Hughes, one of the leading lights of the Harlem Renaissance, an amazing poet and writer of fiction and essays as well, took a more nuanced approach, and he published a very significant essay entitled The Negro Artist in the Racial Mountain. It's a pretty short but profound piece. And in it, he engages in a dialogue of sorts with an unnamed young Black poet, a very talented one, who had told Hughes, "I don't want to be a Negro poet, I just want to be a poet." And Hughes's response is that what he's really saying, without realizing it, is that he wants to be a white poet. And Hughes then talks about how the Black middle class often raises its youth to disdain working class African Americans and to revere the white middle class and upper class whites and their culture. But there's so much to be found that's rich and original and engaging in working class Black culture. The example he gives is jazz. As he puts it, jazz to me is one of the inherent expressions of Negro life in America, the eternal tom-tom beating in the Negro soul, the tom-tom of revolt against weariness in a white world, a world of subway trains and work, 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 the tom-tom of joy and laughter and pain swallowed in a smile, end quote. This is his way of saying, follow your roots, celebrate what is authentic about Black culture. And if that's embraced by the dominant society, fine. If it's not, who cares? You've been true to yourself.
Clearly, there are political overtones to these themes, even if they are not directly embraced. Can you say more about that specifically? I'm interested to know to what extent Marcus Garvey's Black nationalism movement, which was also pretty popular in the 1920s, was that associated in any way to the Harlem Renaissance? Did the two more or less operate independently of one another?
They did not operate independently because Marcus Garvey and the UNIA, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, were based in New York, and he was getting the Black Star line going, his Black shipping line. There's inevitable contact and interaction. There are photographs taken by prominent Harlem Renaissance artists of Marcus Garvey, public parades, for example. And if we look at the UNIA and Marcus Garvey as an expression of Black independence, Black nationalism, you know, this is an attribute of the Harlem Renaissance, that we need to be self-supporting and take care of ourselves, especially in an often hostile environment, including a political environment that's hostile. Another connection we have between Marcus Garvey and the UNIA and the Harlem Renaissance, the emerging national security state, which included an impressive surveillance apparatus by this time, the Bureau of Investigation, which was the forerunner of the FBI, and also the Military Intelligence Division of the General Staff of the U.S. Army. During the World War I era, they've been closely monitoring African-Americans they believed to be radical. This included Garvey, and he would eventually be deported for his actions and for the intelligence gathered in the surveillance. That sort of surveillance spilled over into an intense and sustained monitoring of Black writers of the Harlem Renaissance. And this is something that just didn't occur in the 1920s, but continued into the 1930s and 40s. Tens of thousands of pages of intelligence about many leading Black writers of the Harlem Renaissance. And J. Edgar Hoover even had plans to detain these individuals if there was a sort of national emergency. He had this file of radicals that he was going to go after, not just African Americans, but white Americans on the left and active in radical movements. So I think we see another connection there.
Hmm. You have written on 1919 and the racial violence that occurred in that year. Do these instances of violence feed into the rise of the Harlem Renaissance?
Yes. So we see the intense racial violence that breaks out in the United States in 1919. Showing itself in the literature of the Harlem Renaissance. A prominent example is a novel published by NAACP leader Walter White. It's entitled The Fire in the Flint. And it's about two brothers, two African-American brothers in the South, one brother, Bob, becomes active in organizing sharecroppers. He's a representation of the radical side of the new Negro movement. Kenneth represents racial uplift. He's a striver. He's gone to college. He's opening up a shop as a pharmacist, I believe. And he tells his brother early on in the novel, you know, I don't want to get involved with all this political stuff. I'm just going to work hard, mind my own business, and prosper. But he can't because he's in this environment where racial terrorism directed against Blacks is pretty common. And so we see this transformation of Kenneth from someone who believes he can separate himself from it to understand that, understanding that because he's African-American, he can be targeted at any time. So Walter White, who traveled to the sites of 1919's violence against African-Americans to investigate it for the NAACP, fictionalizes his real life experiences to show how Kenneth and, you know, as a representation in literature, African-Americans themselves can't avoid this. So it does show itself in the literature. There's also a short story published by a Black female writer in the Harlem Renaissance in which one of the characters decides not to have children because she doesn't want her sons to be lynched later in life. She lost a brother and a father to lynching. This is a fictional story, but one based on real life history at the time.
Yeah. White's novel sounds like, in a way, a restatement of the old conflict between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois from the 1890s. Is that, was White really seeking to weigh in on that controversy, in effect?
You know, that's a great observation. I don't know if White had that intention, but certainly the similarity presents itself in the story. Yes. Yeah.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
How was the Harlem Renaissance received by the public at large, which I guess is another way of saying white America? Obviously, it had a huge impact within the African American community, but certainly others outside of it would have been aware of it. Was there support, criticism? I'm sure there's both, but can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So, probably the most common and popular way white Americans of the 1920s encountered the Harlem Renaissance was through its music, through jazz. And because so much of the Renaissance was situated in Harlem, there were lots of places to go to see and hear this musical performance, most famously the Cotton Club. But many of these venues did not accept African-Americans as clients, only as performers, which gives us real insight into the limits of the acceptance of African-American culture and African-Americans as equals. The literature of the Harlem Renaissance did reach an audience outside of Black readers, but again, there were limits. You know, the culture industry was controlled by pretty much white men. And there were editors who were interested in publishing diverse voices, to use a modern term, but they tended to think of it as, well, on our, you know, fall catalog, we've got a black author, so we don't need another one. So it's almost as if they had this token view of what should be done. So a lot of black culture producers, especially writers, felt frustrated in reaching the mainstream because there were limits to how much their work would be put out there. There's also the issue of patronage. So a lot of participants in the Harlem Renaissance had wealthy white patrons who provided financial support and lobbied for their work. But in many cases, the patrons were motivated by a sense that people, Americans of African descent, had connections to primitive culture that had been lost in these modern times. And they saw them in this demeaning way as voices, as primitive voices that could hearken back to these mysterious cultures and bring them to the modern world. And so, as you might imagine, that created a lot of frustrations and difficulties for these individuals who wanted to be full-fledged artists in their own right. And again, this is something that Langston Hughes writes about very nicely. He has an autobiographical essay entitled Patron and Friend, in which he talks about his difficult, conflicted relationship, I should say, with an older white woman who provides a lot of financial support for him.
Mm. When you talk about jazz, I know that jazz, originally an African American cultural product, gets co-opted by, you know, the immediate example that comes to everyone's mind because the name is so perfect is Paul Whiteman, and so white people start recording jazz music, and it becomes wildly popular that way. Did something similar happen with other forms of like for example, literary or artistic projects? You have white painters or writers starting to mimic that style?
I don't think we see it to the extent that we see it with jazz. And we do see influence and shared creativity. So I don't know that I would say, like in the artistic realm, especially in painting, we see mimicry, but rather influence. That is taken up or felt by both white and black painters, for example, and also in literature. Now, a prominent example of a white author who was active in the Harlem Renaissance and who did consciously adopt African-American idiom in his literature is the white author Carl Van Vechten. And Van Vechten was an enthusiastic supporter of Black artists and writers. He was a contributor to The Crisis. He weighed in on what should be the purpose of African-American art in a special questionnaire, which he himself wrote and which solicited answers from both Black and white writers and intellectuals. H.L. Mencken was one, for example. Mm-hmm. But in one of his works, you know, he believes like that he can speak for African Americans, and you know, the work actually contains a racial slur, which he did not believe would be problematic to use, because he felt he was so immersed in Black culture that he was an honorary member, and so that led him to appropriate this idiom and use it in ways that many critics have looked back and say, well, you know, there's an exploitive element here, or it's coming from a position of him believing he's still superior to the people he's writing about.
Yeah, and the very fact that you have a white man weighing in on what black culture ought to be would today, as the kids say, problematic.
Problematic, yeah. And this gets to the dilemma. I mean, I think this is one of the reasons the Harlem Renaissance is important, because we have these discussions today? To what extent should a racial group have a distinctive culture? To what extent is it appropriate for an outside group, especially a dominant group, to enjoy that culture, you know, in whatever form you take it in? And, you know, we don't want, do we want a world in which we don't have this acculturation, this mixture? I mean, that's what produces jazz. That's what produces a rich American literature and art. So we're trying to find a balance there, and we're not the first generation to do this. I mean, this is going on in the Harlem Renaissance. And I think today, you know, no one is going to make the argument that, oh, people of African descent in America never had any culture. I mean, that's been settled, but it wasn't settled in the 1920s. And to bring up another prominent figure of the Harlem Renaissance, the historian and book collector Arthur Schomburg, in a key essay published in The New Negro, an Interpretation, which is the classic text of the Harlem Renaissance. It was published in 1925 and edited by Elaine Locke. Schomburg recounts as a school child being told that Africans and people of African descent had no history, no culture. And he made it his life work to prove that wrong by collecting the artifacts of it and doing the historical work. And his life's work is now at the New York Public Library as the Schomburg Collection. It's still a major important research destination for scholars working on anything related to African-American history, really.
I also have to wonder, 1920s is well known for the Harlem Renaissance, but it's also known as one of the, maybe the great high point of the Ku Klux Klan. And I understand the Klan at this time was probably more interested in going after Catholic immigrants than African Americans, but did organizations like this, you know, I guess we would call hate groups today, did they pay any attention to this at all, or did they directly take aim at it?
I don't think they paid much attention to it. One thing we do see going on is, I mean, the Harlem Renaissance and it, you know, the members, they're very aware of the rise of the Klan, and they see it spread across the United States. And we're accustomed to thinking about the Ku Klux Klan as a rural Southern organization, but as historians know, in the 1920s, it is experiencing the greatest growth in the upper Midwest. And out west in states like Oregon and Nebraska and Washington State. And it's to be found in cities as well as rural areas. You know, the unifying mission for the Klan of this era was encapsulated in the phrase 100% Americanism. And there was a prominent Klan leader from Texas named Hiram Evans who defined 100% Americanism in this way: native white Protestant supremacy. And when Klan leaders like Evans spoke about African Americans, I mean, you hear some surprising things. There's one unnamed Klan member who said, look, African Americans are part of this country, and they are due certain rights as long as they know their place. So that's his way of saying, you know, native white Protestant supremacy. So for people like that, you know, they're, you know, if there's Black culture, as long as they keep it to themselves, and from the Klan's point of view, don't try to pollute what they believe, the Klan believes, to be pure white culture, then fine.
Very interesting.
Yeah, but they're going to, you know, be very much intent on preventing a spread or an acceptance of it.
Mm. Well, one last thing I'd like to explore. What have been the lasting effects of the Harlem Renaissance? Why is it? What influence did it have on later generations? Why is it still relevant today?
The influences today are so widespread, and I'll provide a few examples. We haven't talked a lot about art, so I want to bring up the Black artist Aaron Douglas. who did some of the illustrations for that key text I mentioned a little bit ago, The New Negro, An Interpretation. Douglas blended a machine age aesthetic, right? So this is a feature of modern art in the 1920s. And he brought in Cubist and Art Deco motifs, again, you know, very much of the era and coming out of Western civilization, European civilization, but he blended Egyptian and African elements as well. And so he has this amazing painting, which was done for the Texas Centennial Expo in Dallas in the 1930s. It was entitled Into Bondage, and it shows enslaved Africans being brought in a coffle, a chain, to a ship to cross the Atlantic. And it's just a beautiful painting that when you look at today, you can just see its influence in art to come. And though it's almost 100 years old, it is just such an exceptional piece of American art. I mean, yes, of the Harlem Renaissance, but it is a wonderful American painting as well. The poetry of Langston Hughes has very much stood the test of time. And it's deceptively simple poetry. And it's easy to read it and think, oh, this is just prose kind of broken up as a poem. But it needs to be read aloud, because that's when you get into the musicality of Hughes's poems and his poetry. So The Negro Speaks of Rivers is a poem that today can be read by young people and old as a outstanding poem about America, about Africans in America and African-Americans, but also American history. And so this is something that can't just be considered a Black poem, though it is very much out of the Harlem Renaissance and of African-American literary traditions, but it should speak to every American, even today, about the history of their country.
You're mentioning that you only really appreciate Hughes' work as it ought to be appreciated by reading it aloud. This leads me to ask whether we might trace the hip-hop movement to the poetry that comes from Langston Hughes and others of the movement.
I think so. I think so, yes. I mean, this oral tradition, which was so important in West African cultures and which comes to the United States through the Atlantic slave trade and which enriches American culture, yes. You know, the construction of verse and including impromptu verse. And I mean, there's a connection there. I think in the, you know, just to mention two Black artists active today, Kerry James Marshall and Kehinde Wiley. I mean, you look at their canvases and I think we can trace what they do to the Harlem Renaissance as well.
Very interesting. One last thing, are there any books you have mentioned Alain Locke's The New Negro, any more recently published sources that could that our listeners might want to take a look at?
Well, I think the classic text I've mentioned a couple times already, The New Negro, An Interpretation, was republished in the late 1990s as The New Negro, Voices of the Harlem Renaissance. I think that's a great beginning because it's a collection of poems and stories and essays and illustrations, as mentioned, including those by Aaron Douglas. This is just a great way to get a sense of the sweep and the scope and the ambition of the Harlem Renaissance. The poetry of Langston Hughes can be found online. The Poetry Foundation has recordings of Hughes reading his own work. I mean, this is a great way to hear it out loud, to hear the poet himself read it. James Weldon Johnson published a book in 1912, which was then reissued at the height of the Harlem Renaissance in 1927, entitled Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man. It's a novel, but it's presented as an autobiography. And there's even a prefatory note that appears to establish the nonfiction credentials of the work, but it was actually written by Johnson himself. So this is a great example of modernist literature. It's a very short and brief read, but it touches upon a lot of themes of the Harlem Renaissance and the problem of race in America. The narrator is someone who can pass as white. And this is a theme we haven't talked about, but this is prominent in the Harlem Renaissance as well. The notion of passing and the fears that creates in the dominant culture at the time. So that's a great work to look at as well.
Yeah. Well, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much, David, for joining us today. I could go on talking about this forever, but we're about out of time. I think what we really need to take away from this is today it's almost taken for granted, I hope, how much African American influence there has been on American culture. And I think we really ought to reflect on how much of this tradition comes out of the 1920s and the Harlem Renaissance. So once again, thank you, Dave, for joining us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on The American Idea.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.